Hello, everyone. It is a beautiful Tuesday morning, 10 a.m. This is Mitch, Big Mitch, Mitch Saunders. I'm here once again hosting Swing Politics for WMFO 91.5 Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. I'm going to make sure that everything's all good, that I'm ready to go, and I will be right back on the air. All right, now that we seem like we are ready to go, I am very excited for today's topic for Swing Politics, because it's the U.S. Senate. What is more exciting than the U.S. Senate? I mean, come on. So we'll be talking today about Senate primaries, because there has been a lot of news going on with Senate primaries from everywhere, from California to Ohio to Montana, Maryland, everywhere, Arizona. There has been a lot going on both behind the scenes and sort of in front of the public that I think is really important to be discussing today. And we're going to get started with Montana, because that will be one of the most hotly contested U.S. Senate races of this cycle. Now, the incumbent is Senator John Tester. He was first elected in 2006. He was re-elected in 2012 and 2018, all with small margins. He ousted an incumbent in 2006, Conrad Burns, and had very close races in both 2012 and 2018. And he is going to be running his toughest Senate race to date against, now it seems like, the Republican nominee is Tim Sheehy, who is an aeronautics entrepreneur of sorts. Beyond that, we don't really know a whole lot about him. He has no experience in politics, as you're going to see is a common theme today in many of these Republican primaries. But the big deal was that Matt Rosendale, who is the House Freedom Caucus, you know, super right-wing representative from Montana's first congressional district, declared Senate that he was hopping into the Senate primary, that it was a big deal. And the same day that he hopped into the Senate race, Trump made an endorsement of Tim Sheehy. And this was a little bit, not necessarily a shock, but it was a bit surprising for the Rosendale campaign and I believe Rep Rosendale himself. I think that in the statement that Trump posted on Truth Social, he said that Rosendale was, you know, a good guy and he really wanted him to run for re-election, but they really needed to win this seat or something of that nature. And that's why he was endorsing Tim Sheehy. And wouldn't you know it, about a week after that, Rosendale dropped his bid, which might be the quickest turnaround, because he filed. He did all of the paperwork. Might have been the quickest turnaround of a Senate campaign ever. I really don't know of one that's shorter, personally. The reason why Republicans weren't so keen on Rosendale, specifically the NRSC, the National Republican Senatorial Committee, which funds and makes sure that they support the candidate they want to see win in the primary, was that Rosendale ran against Tester in 2018, and he was the Republican nominee, and he lost. 2018 was a big blue wave. And so that's sort of with Tester's incumbency, and there was still more ticket splitting at the time because it was the partisanship and polarization wasn't as strong, and even in 2018, that it is today. People were skeptical of Rosendale's ability to win, and also the fact that he was an antagonist for the Republican caucus. He was not helpful in getting Kevin McCarthy's speakership role. He was one of the handful that sort of were holdouts for that vote, and he became a thorn in the Republican side. And so whether or not he was popular enough with Republicans, whether or not he could win it, is sort of unclear, versus Sheehy seems to be more of a shoo-in. But this race is not anywhere close to over. I mean, it's a Trump plus 16 state, which is really, really brutal in a presidential year when for John Tester to overcome. In a midterm or an off-year election, voters are more likely to split their ticket, or maybe they're traditional Republicans, but they really like this one Democrat, or maybe a Democrat feels like, you know, they would vote Democrat at the top of the ticket, but maybe in a down ballot race, they wouldn't feel so comfortable. In a presidential year, that really doesn't happen. In presidential years, you have Democrats turn out and vote for Democrats, you have Republicans turn out and vote for Republicans, and partisanship can really be the death knell for you in a state that's so Trumpy. Trump plus 16 is not like North Carolina, which is Trump plus 2. For Tester to win, he has to convince a number of voters, sort of more than he ever has in his past elections, most likely. And it's possible. I mean, there was just a survey. There was a poll from Survey USA, which is a highly rated pollster by 538, and it showed both Rosendale, when he was in the race, Rosendale and Sheehy losing to Tester 49-40. I think sort of the main point is that in this poll, they said 19% of Republicans would vote for Tester, which is crazy crossover. He gets 1 out of 5 Republicans, then Tester will probably win. And if Tester wins, then Democrats are very likely going to hold the Senate. It's no guarantee, but it's likely. What's interesting about this poll is that Tester is at 49% with both candidates, which indicates that Rosendale isn't necessarily weaker than Sheehy. But it does indicate that because Tester is at 49 and both them are at 40, that they have lower name recognition. Both Republicans have more room to grow, whereas Tester's ceiling might be 49%. He might not be able to get above 50%. He might have to win the election with a plurality of voters, which is possible. He's done it in 2006 and in 2012. But it's, for someone who is so well known, to get only 49% is not amazing. Yet, it's an early poll in February, and you have 8 months of campaigning ahead of you. So that's definitely a really interesting development, that you have the NRSC-backed, more moderate, we don't really know policy. Policy doesn't really matter. It's more about posturing. And Sheehy is just seen as the moderate relative alternative to a once-failed candidate in Matt Rosendale, who is a House representative who is just not good to his own party. And this brings up something that the NRSC chair, Steve Daines, he is the senator from, he is the junior senator from Montana, actually, trying to oust his senior counterpart. He is the chair of the National Republican Senatorial Committee. And from what I understand from articles and from sort of through the grapevine, is that the NRSC chair and Trump have made a bit more of a ceasefire agreement to not go at each other in terms of these Senate primaries. In 2022, when Florida Senator Rick Scott was the NRSC chair, he played a much more hands-off role and didn't really endorse candidates in Republican primaries. And this led to a lot of whack job Republicans getting the nominations for their Senate seats and then losing. These people included Dr. Oz, Herschel Walker, Blake Masters. These people were not vetted, were not qualified, and voters saw that in the midterms, and that's why Democrats held on to the Senate. But in this case, Steve Daines is a bit more experienced, and also it was the Republican candidates that were put up in 2022, the NRSC chair did nothing, but Trump did the endorsements. It was Trump's, you know, sort of unilateral endorsement that pushed these candidates to become the nominees and then to become failed Senate candidates, failed Senate nominees for the Republican Party. But in 2024, in this cycle, Daines is making sure that Trump doesn't quite as much interfere and that they kind of pick and choose which races they each want to take. So in Montana, I believe that I don't know if Daines really had any sway over Trump. It seems super unlikely. But they at least came to the agreement, either independently or together, that they would not endorse Rosendale because the NRSC, that at least Trump would not endorse Rosendale because the NRSC had already endorsed Sheehy. This will continue to be a theme today that we'll get into when we discuss these other Senate races. I think one where you have a huge Republican Republican victory in terms of their which candidate they got was in Maryland. Maryland, Larry Hogan, the former governor, he was governor from 2014 to 2022, has decided to jump into the Senate primary. It's very likely that he will be the nominee. I would say that it comes as a little bit of a shock that Hogan is deciding to, so we're going to move away from Montana, we're going to Maryland now. It's a little bit of a shock that Hogan would be interested in, he would be interested in sort of jumping into the Senate where there's a lot of Trumpites, there's going to be even more of them, and he is an avowed, from what I understand, anti-Trumper, which I'm not totally convinced about. I mean, you know, people see Hogan as this wonderful moderate, as this person who knows how to consensus build and is sort of willing to work across the aisle. And I think that that might be true in some instances, but we have a lot that is sort of clouded about his time in the governorship and in the seat for that was essentially the president of Maryland. He was dealing with a Republican, with a Democratic legislature. This Democratic legislature had super majorities of the Democrats. So what would happen is Democrats would pass a bill with super majorities. It would go to Larry Hogan's desk as the governor for his signature, either to veto it or to sign it into law. And Hogan would often veto the law that was good, anything from. You know, abortion access, climate change, tackling sort of any of the standard gun control, standard liberal issues, and Hogan would veto it. So then it would go back to the state legislature, and the state legislature would override his veto with their supermajority, Democrats' supermajority. Then Larry Hogan would go on the news and proclaim how, you know, moderate and bipartisan he is because he, you know, will take credit for the good effects of the bill that he sort of didn't really sign in, but he would make some sort of statement that would assume it to be that he had an important role in getting this bill passed, when the reality of the situation is it was the Democratic State House and the Democratic State Senate that overrode his veto in order to get the law passed, and then he takes credit for what the bill did. That was a constant Larry Hogan cycle. So just like every other Republican, he's a hack. That being said, to the average voter in Maryland, they like Larry Hogan. They don't have a problem with him. They think, yeah, he was a good governor. They have Wes Moore now as the governor, and they say, yeah, we like Wes Moore too. But they don't see, they see him because of that. They see him as a beautiful bipartisan who knows how to sort of work across the aisle and fix politics. When the reality of the situation is that he'll vote 9 times out of 10 with the Republican caucus, the Republican caucus, which is comprised of people like Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Ron Johnson, these people who are crazy right-wingers. But the NRSC wanted Larry Hogan, and so did Mitch McConnell, and they got what they wanted. The reality of the situation is that Maryland voting for a Republican governor, and this is a very common theme, voting for a Republican governor does not mean that voters will be open to voting for a Republican, to that same Republican senator, especially in a presidential year. I'll give you a few examples in recent history. In 2002, there was a Republican governor elected in Hawaii, if you can believe it or not. Her name was Linda Lingle, and she won in 2002 and 2006, one of which those elections was against Mazie Hirono, the senior senator from the from Hawaii, and Hirono lost to Lingle. So 2010, Lingle is termed out. And in 2012, she runs for the U.S. Senate race. Popular governor. People really liked her. The news cycle really, really enjoyed that the former governor was running, really made it a real race. And she lost by 30 points, 25 points. You then have in 2018, a more recent example, Phil Bresden. Phil Bresden was the governor of Tennessee. He was elected. Basically, every county voted for Phil Bresden in 2006 and then in 2010. Fairly certain he was reelected in 2010. Yes. Sorry. No, wrong. Sorry. 2002. He was elected in 2002 and 2006. With huge majorities of the vote, like 40%. He decided in 2018, when it was the blue wave, that he was going to run against Marsha Blackburn, who was the Republican senator. To fill Bob Corker's seat. And he lost by 15%. Didn't matter how popular he was back in the day. He lost by an enormous margin. In 2020, even more recent, you had from Montana, you had Governor Bullock, Steve Bullock, who ran for U.S. president and suspended his campaign super early. Bullock decided when he was termed out in 2020. He was elected in 2012. He was reelected in 2016. When he was termed out in 2020, he decided that he was going to run for the U.S. Senate race in Montana, which was a huge win for the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. This was clutch to put Montana into play. He lost by 10 points. And this was the last presidential cycle that he was running. The sort of story here is that if you're a Republican senator, if you're a Republican governor from a deep blue state, you're not going to win in a Senate race because a Senate race is a federal race and voters have a sort of different understanding about those. Also, most likely, you're probably facing an incumbent in a lot of these instances. I know Lingle was facing an incumbent, and so was Bullock. In Montana. Bresden wasn't, but sort of the point still stands is that these popular Democratic governors who voters really liked did not vote for them at the federal level to go to the U.S. Senate. They might have maybe overperformed what a regular, you know, generic Democrat would have done in their state, but overperforming doesn't mean anything if you don't win. So to say, for some reason, that Larry Hogan is going to be different. He's going to be different than the rest of these candidates because, you know, this reason, that reason, bipartisan, more recent, doesn't matter. When you have a governor moving to the Senate, it's a totally different beast. So yes, he might perform better than, you know, a regular Republican would in Maryland, a regular MAGA Republican, or even a moderate Republican. But he's running against two Democrats, Angela Alsobrooks and David Trone, both of which would beat him handily. Sure, he might get 44-45% in the state. I think that's his upper limit, but you can't win with 45% in Maryland. And Maryland voted for Biden by 30 points. It was, I believe, the third most Biden voting. Biden had the third greatest margin there of any state that he had. What Hogan does do is he does require the the DSCC, the Democratic side, to spend a little bit more money than they would like to on Maryland. But that being said, I don't think they need to spend much, because the Democrats, Democratic candidates will have their own fundraising apparatuses. And the only other weird downside is that the NRSC could end up spending more money on a race they know they won't win. I think that this race is perfect for the news media. That's what Larry Hogan jumping into this race does, is it allows pollsters to say, oh, look at this thing where, you know, the Democrat running, Angela Alsobrooks or David Trone, is losing to Larry Hogan by 5 points. But the reason why is because Larry Hogan has 44% and the Democrat has 39%, because they don't know who the Democrat is yet. Everyone knows Larry Hogan. It'd be hard to find a voter who doesn't know Larry Hogan. But they don't know Angela Alsobrooks, and they probably don't know David Trone either. So, any semblance, any idea that the Republicans are going to pick up a seat in Maryland is ludicrous. That being said, the media can milk more airtime off of it. Larry Hogan can hop on all of his all the media, you know, Fox News, MSNBC, CNN, so we can get a prime spot on CNN's, you know, election night coverage of something, all while stating during the time that he passed this and that and that and this, which he actually initially vetoed before he took credit for the bill that the Democrats passed, because Republicans don't do anything. They take credit or cause problems for Democrats to have so they win the next election so they can do nothing about it. Moving away from Maryland, we're going to move to Wisconsin. The Republicans also got good news there when David Clark, who was, I believe, the former sheriff of Milwaukee, decided that he was not going to run for he was not going to run for the U.S. Senate race. This was a big deal for Republicans because David Clark is a really extreme MAGA crazy guy. He was the sheriff for a long time of Milwaukee, which is deep blue, but he was the sheriff from 2002 to 2017. People don't really know him. I didn't know the name until sort of they were discussing it. But sort of regardless of that, Clark has decided to drop out, which leaves the field largely open for a candidate called Eric Hoved. Don't know who that is. He's a businessman. Very similar to Tim Sheehy. Republicans right now are they like recruiting businessmen. They think that they're what's sort of the best for their party in terms of them being able to win, which I think is a weird. I think in 2022 there was kind of a similar idea, but not quite to the same extent. Whereas the NRSC is actively recruiting candidates that are self-funders. Because Republicans can't raise money, and they know that all the money that they're raising is going to go to Trump's legal fees. It's crazy. I mean, tactically, the NRSC is being smart because they know they won't have money, but it's a crazy thing to say that Republicans won't have money to fund their Senate races. Like, that's just a wild thing. If you were to tell that to anyone a decade ago, they'd laugh in your face, because Democrats were the party that always were trying to sort of catch up to Republicans, at least down ballot. Obama was a crazy fundraiser, but down the ballot, Democrats couldn't really get as much money as Republicans could, because Republicans were the party of the suburbs, and they were the party of wealth. And now that paradigm has shifted. So it's also happening in Pennsylvania, where Dave McCormick, who is the who's just a guy from Connecticut, is running for the U.S. Senate race in 2024 in Pennsylvania against Bob Casey. He's really going to go unopposed because the NRSC is endorsing him. But you'd think you'd want someone with political experience. I mean, we when Democrats look for candidates, we look for people with experience, with people who sort of have years under their belt, who have connections with voters. Republicans just don't care. Just give me someone that has money. Just give me someone sort of that can make something competitive in some way. Even though they have congressmen who could run. They have state senators. They have former statewide officials, though those statewide officials are now lacking more and more because Republicans keep losing in swing states. That's the other reason why they don't have good candidates, is because they keep losing. But Republicans have a ton of candidates in Pennsylvania row offices, like treasurer and comptroller and all those types of, you know, statewide but sort of low-level offices. It's very, very strange that Republicans are endorsing the strategy of just find someone with money. It doesn't matter if they have experience. But getting back to the sort of main discussion of Wisconsin with Eric Hovde, he's running against, or presumed to be the nominee, running against Senator Tammy Baldwin. Baldwin was elected in 2012, and she was reelected in 2018, both by really large margins, but both of those were big Democratic years, especially for the U.S. Senate. Baldwin is the first ever sort of out lesbian senator, and she will, in my opinion, doesn't matter who the Republican is, she will be reelected. I'm not super worried. I mean, Wisconsin was a super close race in in 2020. It's likely shaping up to be the same in 2024, and Baldwin can outrun Biden by a handful of points. And the margin in Wisconsin can't be more than a point, and if it is, then it's going to be a landslide one way or another. But Baldwin will outperform. She has a rapport with voters. Also, the Wisconsin voters just reelected Ron Johnson. And I think voters are very much inclined in the state to have a bit more of a balanced partisanship. And so they won't oust Tammy Baldwin, who they really like, who's been she's a really, really good Democrat. She's a pragmatic progressive in all the right ways. She sort of isn't super in the national eye, in the national spotlight, but she does really good work. She's exactly what you want to see out of a Democratic senator. And I think she's great for the caucus. And she won't lose the race unless it's, you know, a Trump crazy victory where he wins Wisconsin more than he won it in 2016, which is, it just can't be. It really just can't be. Like, it's not going to happen. Trump 2024 cannot possibly be more strong than Trump 2016. But Republicans got the candidate they wanted. They ousted the sort of MAGA guy, and Trump really didn't have any involvement in the matter. This is, again, sort of a very strange thing where Trump is not putting his hands in, and the NRSC is doing their own operating, and Trump is not being involved. This story shifts quite a bit if you're looking at the Ohio Republican primary. So in Ohio, there are three Republicans that are vying to run against Senator Sherrod Brown. Sherrod Brown is one of my all-time favorite U.S. senators because he is such a champion of workers' rights, union rights, the expansion of the minimum wage, abortion protections. You can't find a better senator than Senator Sherrod Brown. He recently did a podcast in a sort of interview with Pod Save America, and I implore you to check it out because he's just so good. He's just awesome. If you can donate to one Democratic senator or one Democrat this cycle, donate to Sherrod Brown and then donate to John Tester. Don't donate anywhere else. donate to you know, any Democrats in competitive states. Don't donate to the you know, uncompetitive seats. But regardless, Senator Brown was elected in 2006, actually ousting incumbent Mike DeWine, who would go on to become the governor of Ohio, who was elected in 2018. But Brown was elected in 2006, reelected in 2012 and 2018, and he's running again in 2024. You have three Republicans running against him in this Trump plus eight state, which is rapidly moving to the right. The white working class voters, the Democratic Appalachian Mountain voters, are really, really being lost in Ohio. And there isn't a big metro that is really picking up the work in terms of the suburbs, the surrounding suburbs. So there's Cincinnati, Cleveland, and Columbus, and none of them are like Atlanta, Georgia, which has a huge metro and a really sprawling area. These are all areas that their surrounding suburbs are becoming more Democratic, but not at a rate quick enough to offset the rurals that are racing to the right. And this proves to be a problem for Brown. Ohio is seemingly extremely inelastic, and it's going to be a super difficult race for him to win. He's going to have to outrun Biden at the top of the ticket by a lot, because Biden lost the state by eight last time. And the Republicans that are running are Secretary of State Frank LaRose, who was just reelected in 2022. He's notable for, you know, voter suppression, because that's what Republican secretaries of state do now. It's him, Matt Dolan, who is a state senator, and he can self-fund because he's a millionaire, and Bernie Moreno, who is a businessman. And Bernie Moreno is the most MAGA of the three. They're all very MAGA, very Republican, Trump-supporting types. I mean, they'll never disavow Dear Leader. But Bernie Moreno, the reason why he is so notable is because he got Trump's endorsement very recently. And I don't totally know exactly why. I mean, my guess is as good as anyone else's in that he just has... He has the sort of Trump appeal about him and the sort of bending the knee in such a way that is really overt that I think... I know Frank LaRose has sort of criticized Trump, at least when he was in office, when he was elected in 2018, 2020. Frank LaRose criticized Trump. And Matt Dolan is sort of just not much of a name. And I guess Trump liked Moreno. What's also notable is that the NRSC... stated that they are going to stay hands off of this race in the primary. They'll help whoever the nominee is, but they are not going to involve themselves in the primary. And so this goes to this ceasefire that the NRSC with Steve Daines has forged with Trump. They don't really want to get in each other's way and sort of nominate bad candidates like they did in 2022. Because Daines doesn't want to be on Trump's bad side, and Trump wants to win and have a U.S. Senate that's on his side. In this case, I think he's done the worst possible thing. I think that that this was a very, very tactical mistake by the NRSC. Frank LaRose would have been a shoo-in to win this election. Secretary of State, he's been on the ballot twice. People like him. He's just not super MAGA. And if the NRSC came out and endorsed Frank LaRose, you would have had a proxy war between the NRSC and the MAGA, the sort of full Trump side, but you probably would have at least had a chance for the candidate that's likely going to win to sort of have a leg up in the general. Whereas I think Moreno is just not a very strong candidate. People don't know him. He's raised less than Dolan, according to the FEC, since according to the sort of end of 2023 reports. Matt Dolan just seems to be a no-name, but Moreno has the Trump endorsement, and it's really, really likely that Moreno gets the nomination. The fact that he's so extreme doesn't help his candidacy, but it also, It's Ohio. It voted for Trump in 2020. It's an extreme state now. It's no longer the bastion of sort of the Democratic Party when it used to be. Iowa and Ohio and the working class areas, because of the Republican misinformation ground game, which has been so strong, and the sort of the fact that culture is the thing that dominates politics today. It's not really policy. It's just, are you woke or are you not, which is not much of anything, but it gets Republicans rallied. And those same Republicans are Republicans that want to have all the Social Security, welfare programs, minimum wages, and the like that Democrats are supporting, and Republicans are actually working in their funding bills to cut. So that's good. That's always fun. We like voters voting against their own interests. It's an enjoyable time in American politics, and really everywhere, because this is a global phenomenon that's occurring. But with Marino as the nominee, I think Brown has a better chance of winning, but I still do believe he is the underdog, because it's going to take a lot to outrun Trump at the top of the ticket. That's going to take a lot of crossover voters. You have another tactical mistake by Republicans in Arizona. This is super weird. The NRSC chair, who I've mentioned a lot, Steve Daines, has come out a few days ago and endorsed Carrie Lake for the U.S. Senate race. Now, if you don't know Carrie Lake, she's, one, insane, and two, she was the Republican gubernatorial nominee in Arizona in 2022. Doug Ducey, who was a popular Republican governor, was elected in 2014, re-elected in 2018, and termed out in 2022. So this was an open race. And Democrats put up their Secretary of State, Katie Hobbs, as the nominee. Again, Democrats putting up someone who has rapport with voters. They've seen her name on the ballot before. They have no problems with her. It's a very, very smart decision. Republicans don't get involved, and the RGA, the Republican Governors Association, doesn't seem to really care, and Carrie Lake wins the nomination. The hallmark about Carrie Lake's candidacy is that she is a notorious 2020 election denier to this day. Carrie Lake, her biggest policy is election denialism. So in this layup election for Republicans, I mean, this is it's a Republican sort of tilting state. It's basically a toss-up now, but in 2022, you knew you were going to come in with a Republican electorate because, hey, it's a Biden midterm. And she just blanked the bed. Can't curse on here. In this really, really easy election to win, she lost by about a point to Katie Hobbs. And in doing so, broke the Republican trifecta that they've had since, since Janet Napolitano, who was the governor of Arizona from 2003 to 2009. Janet Napolitano was tapped to work in the Biden administration, and she was the last Democratic governor of Arizona. And Republicans still have control of the state legislature, but they can't pass anything, because now Katie Hobbs, who's a Democrat, holds the governorship, which is a huge win for Democrats, just an enormous win. So Carrie Lake now is running for U.S. Senate. And after losing the really, really winnable race, where basically any Republican, would have won that race, she said, the NRSC said, we're going to endorse that one, the MAGA one. I don't really think there's anyone else running, from what I understand. But the NRSC is still looking for candidates. So to endorse Carrie Lake is a wild, wild decision. And the incumbent there is Kyrsten Sinema, who is quite the character. And she is very, very likely retiring. I'm almost certain that she's retiring. I know there's been a lot of hemming and hawing by media coverage on her. But the reason why she's retiring is twofold. One, this border bill. She is pissed about the fact that the border bill that got shot down by the House, passed by the Senate, she's pissed that... the border bill passed by the Senate. Yeah, she's pissed that Republicans were really adamant about passing it, and that, you know, Lindsey Graham, who was an avowed supporter of this bill, came out against it. She really, really got sick of Republicans' tactics. And it's why she still caucuses with the Democrats. I think she prefers to be a Democrat. She knows that the Democrats get stuff done, whereas Republicans just bellyache and block. But I think after this border bill debacle, she's just about had it. But also, she's not really fundraising. She is a war chest that she's sitting on. She has a ton of money from her last from her 2018 election campaign, but she's not really raising money. And when you stop raising money, you tend to indicate that you're not really going to be running for re-election. I also think that Sinema doesn't really want to give Republicans any victories, as much as she's sort of not a fan of the lockstep Democratic Party. She's even less of a fan of the Republicans. So I think that she'll retire and she'll go down as an interesting Senate, you know, in a senator in a footnote someday. But the fact that she's also retiring makes this race so much more likely that Democrats are going to win it with Representative Ruben Gallego, who is running, who is a really, really good rep. From Arizona, and I believe he's from the Phoenix area. I'm not totally sure, but again, the Democratic nominee is an elected official who some voters know. He's a representative for the U.S. House who's been reelected multiple times. I believe his ex-wife Kate Gallego is the mayor of Phoenix, and she endorsed him. Like, It confounds me that that Republicans continue to nominate candidates who have no experience, who really don't know how to operate in the national stage, and then the NRSC endorses them when the NRSC was this cycle going to be, you know, more constrained and more judicious about their endorsements. But what's interesting is that it's very likely that the NRSC probably spoke with Trump about this race, and Trump said, look, I'm endorsing Carrie Lake. You can either stay in the race and support someone, or you can, you know, get out and have to spend a whole ton of money to support your candidate. And I think that that's an interesting move by the NRSC to say, we don't want to burn a couple million dollars trying to get someone ahead when we know that anyway, Ruben Gallego is probably going to win this race. So why not just endorse Lake and make it easy on everyone? It's really, really weird. But it's Republican politics today is just, it's not smart. Sometimes they make smart decisions or get lucky in their candidates. They get certain people like Larry Hogan who want to run. But when you have Carrie Lake running in Arizona and you have Larry Hogan running in Maryland, it's kind of a crazy dichotomy of those two races. And Lake will lose. It's not like she's gotten any more popular since 2022. And it's not like the demographics of the voters are going to be more Republican in 2024 than they were in 2022. 2022, Republicans had the turnout advantage. They probably aren't going to have that in 2024. So she's going to lose that race, and the NRSC is making a fool of themselves, especially burning money on this race, but they think at least they're not burning it in the primary. So those are the big stories with the Republican Senate primaries. And there's one big two that I'm going to get into today of the Democratic Senate primaries that are really important to the field in general. One in the general, just one in the primary. And I'll start with California. So in the Democratic primary in California, there are four main candidates that are running. That's Representative Adam Schiff, Representative Katie Porter, Representative Barbara Lee, and baseball coach Steve Garvey. The three representatives are Democrats, and the one Republican is the three representatives are Democrats, and Garvey, the baseball coach, is the Republican. And yet again, it proves the same exact point. It proves literally the exact same point that Democrats promote experience, and Republicans just promote whatever the hell. Maybe they'll have money. That's basically it. But the big deal that's interesting about the California races is that they do a jungle primary system. So there's not a Republican primary, and then a Democratic primary, and the top one from each go head to head in the general. It's a top two system. So every party, every candidate is listed on the ballot from top to bottom, and it could go Democrat, Democrat, Republican, Democrat, 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 Republican, Republican, and you know, so on. And the top two vote getters are the ones that advance the general. So it could be two Democrats. If there's so many Democrats and two really good Republicans, they could get two Republicans. If there is one Democrat and one Republican who got the most votes, then it's going to be those two that go to the general election. And what seems to be going on in the dynamics here is that you have in the race, you have Adam Schiff, who is the, compared to the rest of the Democrats, a relative moderate. Which is definitely a choice because he's super. He's a very, very liberal guy. He supports all of the sort of progressive wing of the party, but not to an extreme degree. And then you have Katie Porter and Barbara Lee, who are sort of vying for that sort of more progressive spot. Schiff has been in the Senate. Has been in the House since the early 2010s, I think. Porter is a 2018 blue wave baby, and I don't remember. When Barbara Lee came into office, but I think she's been there for a while. What the polling seems to be telling the race is that Schiff is in the lead, and then you have Porter and Garvey, and just below them is Barbara Lee. So interestingly, this has really changed the dynamics of this race because the Schiff team, who is in the lead, is spending money to raise up Steve Garvey. Now, why would he be doing this? Doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Why would Schiff want to run against a Republican? Well, the state is California, which voted for Biden by about 30 points, and it's one of the most Democratic states in the nation. If he is running against a fellow Democrat, it's going to be a slog, and it's going to take more convincing to get voters to promote him over another Democrat. If you have a Republican, there's no way California is going to vote for a Republican senator. So Schiff doesn't even need to spend any money. He could sit at home for the entire campaign and just get elected to the U.S. Senate, because he wouldn't need to run against a Republican in California, because Republicans in California are not popular. They don't have the votes. And in doing so, he would also really help the Democrats nationally to keep the Senate. The reason why is that if you have a slog fest between Schiff and Lee or Schiff and Porter, you're going to burn so much money. That should be going. Donors are going to give money to one side or the other, which could be going to John Tester in Montana, Sherrod Brown in Ohio, Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin, Ruben Gallego in Arizona. You know, but if you have a Republican, he doesn't need to spend any money, and he won't be fundraising aggressively. So, in my mind, if I'm a Democratic operative, I'm thinking this is the best thing. So, what? The Schiff campaign has done is made sure that Garvey is seen as the most conservative, because there's enough Republican votes for him to get second place in this jungle primary. So if Schiff is sending out mailers saying Garvey is just super, super MAGA, super Republican, Republicans are going to be more inclined to say, hey, maybe we should vote for that guy. Whereas the Democratic vote is split, shifts at the top of the ticket. Garvey comes in first or second, doesn't matter. And it's a Schiff-Garvey race. Democrats save money nationally. Porter and Lee are not spending a whole lot of money. And that's it. And that money gets diverted to where it should be going. Because nothing kills me more than Democrats with an ambition to win putting themselves over the party. Because that's when Democrats lose. So this race is going to be really interesting. I don't recall when the primary is. I think it's coming up. I feel like it's Super Tuesday, but that might just be presidential. I don't totally know. I would have to look at the calendar. But yeah, it's going to be a big deal. It's going to be a really, really big deal to see how all of these primaries shake out. And the last one that I'll mention today is the New Jersey Senate race. Not the Republican primary, but the Democratic primary. There are two candidates that are running for this, and that's Tammy Murphy, the First Lady of New Jersey, and Representative Andy Kim. So, to give some background, Representative Andy Kim was elected in 2018, ousting a Republican. He was reelected in 2020 and 2022. And there's a very famous, at least in you know, social media circles in politics, there's a very famous picture of Andy Kim on his knees with a dustpan, helping the Capitol staff clean up the rotunda after January 6th. It's one of the most powerful, I think, political images that I've seen, that I recall, in modern politics, and it is so emblematic of Andy Kim, what he does, you know, what he stands for, the people that he's fighting for. He constantly is talking about his two sons, and bringing them into the conversation. He is, he's for the everyman, and he understands what is necessary in this race. He understands what being a good senator is, what a good representative is, and what a good senator would be. You then have Tammy Murphy, who's the First Lady, of New Jersey, who is a Bush voter. She voted for Bush in 2000 and 2004. She is a Wall Street girl. She has experience there. That's sort of where she made her, where she planted her flag. And suddenly, in the primary debate between these two, she came out for Medicare for All. Now, this is kind of shocking because she's not a progressive person, but what she's trying to do is box out Kim and be the sort of more progressive liberal candidate compared to his more moderatism. And the reason why I think she's doing this is because her campaign, which was leading by about, you know, 30 points initially, is now facing a real race against the representative, or against Andy Kim. There was a so the way that the New Jersey sort of primaries go is that the county Democrats in each county get together and they vote on which candidate they would like to endorse for the Senate race. When they choose who they endorse, they will choose that person to put at the top of the ticket versus the other candidate, which is sort of just below them. And they also get to boast and say, this county endorsed me, this county endorsed me, this county endorsed me. And there was a heated race for the Monmouth County election, for the Monmouth County sort of ballot placement endorsement. And there was a deal that was offered for Murphy and Kim to split the endorsement, that they would both be endorsed. And the Murphy camp said no. And when the nomination, or the Yeah, I guess when the election for the nomination came around, Kim won it. And it was a sort of must win for him because Monmouth County is sort of pivotal in terms of this, how this election will go for him. And the specifics are not something that I know a whole lot about. But essentially what's going on is that the momentum is with Representative Kim, and the sort of news around Tammy Murphy, the sort of nepotism of the fact that her husband is governor, the fact that she really doesn't, that she voted for Republicans as recent as, you know, 12 years ago, that she is just sort of in it for herself, really is something that she's battling against. And because of that, she's staking out more progressive positions to get the Democratic, to get the progressive Democrats on board with her and sort of take the wind out of the sails of the Kim campaign. And I don't know if it's necessarily going to work. Andy Kim is a very good, very, very good campaigner. And I think Tammy Baldwin is someone that felt that she could sort of ride into this Senate seat as a Nepo baby, essentially. And she's now learning she can't. So, yeah, I think that, you know, my preference is certainly Representative Kim. I think they would both be good senators, but there's something so unique about Andy Kim that you don't see in politics as much. And it's this bringing everyone in warmth, and he doesn't want to do it for himself. He wants to do it for his kids, to give them a better future, for his community, for his country. He's just the whole package when you're looking for what you want to see in a senator. So I really enjoyed today's show. Talking about the U.S. Senate is always fun. I don't know what we're going to talk about next week. I got through everything on my agenda, which is great. Maybe I'll talk about New York redistricting when there's more news about that, which could shake up the House. But every week, you know, there's new news, so I'm not worried. For now, I'll leave you with my closing. This has been Swing Politics with Big Mitch, and you're listening to 91.5 FM WMFM Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. Thank you so much for listening. I hope I'll be back next week. And yeah, enjoy the rest of your Tuesday, everyone.